Welcome to the official SBGAN podcast, hosted by Dr. Alex Nicely.
Sitting across the table from me today is an eminence, Professor Amit Assaf of the Shaare Zedek Medical Center in Jerusalem, Israel. He is an expert in inflammatory bowel disease, and his expertise today will be shared with us in discussing small biological molecules, and how they are best deployed in treating patients with inflammatory bowel disease, both as you ramp up and select the therapy to be given, and then, if you succeed, in dialing down those molecules, giving the patients treatment holidays or even a permanent remission. Sir, welcome.
Thank you.
Where do we start with an individual patient? An individual patient may come in with inflammatory bowel disease that is not yet brightly aflame, just coals, just smoldering along. Or it may be a crisis of the sort that in my day as a surgical house officer would require an entire colectomy.
So first of all, we have to differ between Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. But severe cases of Crohn's disease usually go very fast to biologic agents. Mm-hmm. In ulcerative colitis, not necessarily. So the first step usually is steroids for severe cases. And if they respond, they can actually begin their maintenance treatment with either 5-ASA or immunomodulators. But if they are not in full remission or in complete remission under 5-ASA and immunomodulators, they will have to go to biologic agents. There are only two biologic agents approved for pediatrics or pediatric patients. And this is, when you think about that, this is a very, very huge gap between adults and pediatric patients. So for adult patients, there are many approved biologics and small molecules. For pediatric patients, there are only two, infliximab and adalimumab. So again, differentiating between Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis, the severe Crohn's disease patients can receive either infliximab or adalimumab, similar efficacy. For the ulcerative colitis patients, infliximab has an advantage over adalimumab, especially in the pace of response. So the pace of response under infliximab is much quicker than adalimumab.
Mm. Here I am, having worked as a histopathologist for some years, and I've often wondered, what do you do when my report comes back as inflammatory bowel disease, unable to differentiate?
Okay, so when we don't know exactly the diagnosis, we have to tailor the treatment, thinking that the treatment should cover both diseases. For example, in a severe IBDU case, I would prefer infliximab over adalimumab because perhaps it's ulcerative colitis, and we know that in ulcerative colitis, infliximab works better than adalimumab. So the treatment should be tailored to cover all options.
For every individual patient, certainly, the tailor must be tailored to cover that particular patient as best as possible. But there are certain primary guidelines that you're going to articulate for us, as in, for example, start with steroids, see how they do, begin with infliximab because you get a quicker and better result, and then, if need be, what happens next?
Okay, so again, we will have to differ between Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. So let's start with Crohn's disease. In a Crohn's disease patient not responding to anti-TNF, the first step, and this is also true for ulcerative colitis, mm-hmm. is to verify that the current treatment is optimized. First of all, before you switch,
before we switch, and I'm waiting for you to drop the other shoe. Is this through blood levels? Is this through? How do you say we're doing the job? The job is to get the drug to the coal face, so to speak, to the mucosa, and it's working there. There's enough of it there to work. And that is blood levels?
So if the patient is not in complete remission, and the goal is, in fact, not only clinical remission, but also biochemical remission, mucosal healing, the prevention of complications and the promotion of growth and bone health. And if we have not achieved these goals under current treatment, so first of all, we have to use TDM, therapeutic drug monitoring. So yeah, serum levels of the drug and measurement of anti-drug antibodies. And to verify that we reach the adequate level of the drug or trough concentration of the drug in the serum with no immunogenicity, so no antibodies. And this is personalized, actually. So
sure.
Some patients need higher trough concentration of each of the drugs, but there is an upper limit. So if the trough concentration is around the upper limit, then you can say this is a pharmacodynamic failure. So enough drug, no response, we can switch.
I'm going to ask you now a how long is a piece of string question, which is to say, how long is we've given it enough time in this patient to alter our therapy? We've given it enough time to move on. These first steps are clearly not working, and we have to increase the dose or shift the agent.
So the traditional practice is to wait until the end of induction. And induction is defined differently between drugs. So infliximab is before the fourth infusion. For adalimumab is before the fourth or fifth injection, and it's different time. So with infliximab, it's usually week 14. With adalimumab, it's week 8, more or less. But even when there is inadequate response during induction, it's better to use TDM and escalate during induction. So it's better not to wait in a non-responsive patient until the end of induction. So if you can measure, it's available and you can measure trough concentration during induction, this is better because you can escalate and achieve the goal at the end of induction rather than just wait and see.
The adverse consequences of waiting are simply prolonged morbidity.
Yeah, so this is a short time. So usually complications develop. It takes time to develop complications. So this is not the risk. The risk is morbidity of the patient. So going back to your previous question, how to do the switch. So again, the differentiation between Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. In Crohn's disease, and this was shown in many indirect comparison between anti-IL-12/23 or anti-IL-23 alone and anti-integrin. In Crohn's disease, there is an advantage to switch. So second line should be anti-IL-23 or anti-IL-12/23. We have currently two drugs that we can use. They are not approved in children, but we can use them. Mm-hmm. One is ustekinumab, which is anti-IL-12/23, and the other one is risankizumab, which is anti-IL-23 against the subunit of P19. And interestingly, there was a very nice comparison between the two drugs, which is head-to-head a trial called the sequence trial, and this was an RCT showing that risankizumab is more efficient than ustekinumab. So again, looking at, you know, the more detailed way to think about switching, probably risankizumab should be the second line after failing anti-TNF in Crohn's disease. In ulcerative colitis, it's not the same. And it depends on the severity of the disease. If the disease is mild to moderate and the patient do not respond, probably the second line should be anti-integrin, vedolizumab. But if there is a severe disease, then the second line should be a small molecule. So anti-Janus kinase or anti-JAK. And in this area, there is also a nice study. This is an indirect comparison between the two anti-JAKs available, tofacitinib and upadacitinib.
I am losing
this
my
is
frank
confusing.
Here.
This is confusing. But upadacitinib showed better efficacy than tofacitinib. So for severe cases, the second line after anti-TNF or infliximab in ulcerative colitis patients should be an anti-JAK and especially upadacitinib.
I'm trying to salvage a small amount of this information for the benefit of my own personal histopathologist's respect. Is there a role after, quote, pharmacodynamic treatment failure of whatever reason for rebiopsy and reassessment to see if initial treatment has made it easier to find out what the disorder is?
Okay, so this is a good question. The rule should be, especially when switching a major therapeutic regimen, not to rely only on serum markers or even fecal markers like fecal calprotectin, because fecal calprotectin can be elevated due to one inflammatory polyp and the rest of the bowel is completely normal. So before a major decision, a repeated evaluation should be performed and it should be based on endoscopic evaluation. So
with biopsy, don't forget the biopsy. Never forget the biopsy.
First of all, what you see is uh-huh. what you get. So ileocolonoscopy with biopsy. So of course, when we perform ileocolonoscopy, we always take biopsy.
Thank you.
And histologic remission should be one of the goals. There is always a question, you know, if you can see mucosal healing but not histological remission, whether you should switch. Mm-hmm. And this should be balanced against the information, which is based on evidence, that in many patients, when you switch from anti-TNF to another group of drugs, in most patients, there is a deterioration. So
there's a sliding back before they pick themselves up and go on.
Yeah. So the best drug that we have are still anti-TNF. And there is always a risk that if you achieved some of the goals, but not all of the goals, and then you switch, the patient will exacerbate. So you have to balance that. So I do not think currently we have enough evidence to switch only based on histological activity. If there is a mild histological activity and there is endoscopic remission or mucosal healing, probably the current treatments should remain and perhaps optimized. We can always add nutritional therapy to the treatment, which can, and it was shown in studies, can enhance the efficacy of the current drug. So we can further achieve the remaining goals by keeping the current treatment and adding a little bit more help with other therapies.
All very well. But you have to run into a couple of patients who don't respond to first-line therapy, then moving along, don't respond to second-line therapy, and third, fourth-line. When do you throw up your hands and say, we're going to pull out the big guns, expensive though it may be, we're going to use two agents at once in this patient?
It's a very good question. A related question should be, what is our last resort before we say, let's use extreme measures.
Sure.
So, unfortunately, we don't have many good options after failure of anti-TNF. In a patient with Crohn disease, we can use small molecules after anti-IL-23 failure. And it's the same with ulcerative colitis. But if that fails, then we are in a junction in which we should decide whether the patient is amenable for surgery. For example, if he is or she is a Crohn's disease patient with a short ileal segment, refractory to any treatment, then the best solution is to take it out.
Understood.
But many patients are not amenable for surgery. And then, and this was shown in a couple of studies, both in adults and children, we can combine two drugs. So two advanced therapies. It can be either two biologics or one biologic and one small molecule. But before the decision, there are some considerations that should be taken into account. First of all, safety. So you should not probably combine two drugs that are deeply suppressing the immune system, such as anti-JAK and infliximab. You can do that, but this is a high risk.
You have to watch your step.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah. The second consideration is, are there any extra-intestinal manifestations deserves to be treated with a specific drug? So, for example, perianal disease. So one of the drugs should be probably anti-TNF, which is the best drug for perianal disease. Joint involvement. So anti-JAKs are perfect for joint involvement. Skin involvement, so psoriatiform lesions, so anti-IL-23 are best for skin lesions.
I know you're building to the climax. What do you do for cholangiopathy?
Okay, so PSC.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, we don't have...
Not yet.
Yet. Good treatment for PSC. There was a thought that vedolizumab, thinking about the mechanism of vedolizumab, anti-integrin, will work for PSC, but it was a negative trial. So currently, we don't have a good treatment for cholangiopathy, except if there is an autoimmune component. But this is another disease. This is... autoimmune hepatitis.
Myelin-Verguny's disease, yes, yes.
Yeah, so So going back to the combination, these are the considerations, so safety and then specific features of the disease, especially extra-intestinal manifestations. This is a very expensive treatment of two biological small molecules, but it was shown to be effective in many refractory patients. And actually, this is the last result that we have now. So two drugs working in different mechanisms on the same inflammatory process, hoping that the patient will respond, but taking into account that there are always the extreme patients that do not respond to anything, even not combination of drugs, and then surgery probably is their last result.
Everybody remembers individual patients whose course surprised one or delighted one or left one sad because one hadn't been able to fix what was wrong. In this field, with these agents, just share an anecdote or two about one patient that you remember because, let's just say that you remember because with the appropriate drug intervention, things went right.
So it's interesting because you always remember the extremes, right? The one that you failed a couple of times and, you know, they kept on going with active disease and very severe patients and the extreme successes that you had a very complicated patient and you succeeded to bring him into complete remission. Usually the middles, I don't remember them very well, hundreds of them. But I can give you an example from last week. So
perfect.
I have a very complicated ulcerative colitis patient who were admitted a couple of times. He failed corticosteroids. He failed very high doses of infliximab. And in acute severe colitis, the third line should be anti-JAK, so upadacitinib. And this is a pill, this is an oral treatment. And he could not, even though he's 14, he could not swallow the pill. And this is a sustained release pill, so the pharmacologist said to me, you know, you cannot crush the pill. I don't know.
What? No applesauce?
So you cannot crush the pill. I don't know what will happen if you crush the pill.
Yeah.
Perhaps some safety issues. And even though we tried to teach him how to swallow, it failed. So, you know, I was thinking to myself, he won't grow horns with the crushed pills, right? And this is his last resort. Otherwise, we should take his colon out. So I said, you know, crush the pill. Maybe we should divide it into two doses, rather than giving it once a day, just to be a little bit on the safer side.
Right.
And it just, in 2 days, he went into complete remission.
Hot damn. An American idiom for, wow, that's great.
Yeah. So this is like, it's the feeling that you do something for the patients that...
Keeps us going.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom, your experience, and that lovely anecdote that reminds us.
Thank
you
very
much. It's about the patients.
Thank you.
Have you picked out a song for us?
Yes.
What is it?
The song is called, it's a song in Hebrew, mm-hmm. called Little Prince. And this is a metaphor using the book.
The Saint-Exupéry.
Yeah, Saint-Exupéry, Little Prince. And it's an anti-war song. The song is about a young person who died in the war, and the legacy that he left behind him. This is a sad song, and it's really an anti-war song, and this is really relevant for these times. It's a beautiful, beautiful metaphor, and a beautiful... was performed beautifully by one of the older bands in Israel. And I think it's really relevant to our times.
If you would like to listen to the song, check out our Spotify playlist, Espigan's Favorite Songs.
Thank you for taking part in the Espigan podcast series. We've really enjoyed having you here.